The Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, getting his first shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine from the HSE Assistant Director of Nursing, Brenda Dillon, in Cork City Hall yesterday, is pictured on the front pages of the Irish Times, Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Sun. "It's great to be vac," says the headline in the Mirror, picking up on the lockdown easing today and the Taoiseach's prediction that we're set to have a good summer if we can keep this progress going. "Top jab," says The Sun. "Today marks a major milestone in the nation's return to normality," says the Irish Daily Mail. The Times describes a major relaxing today of COVID-19 restrictions after 5 months of strict lockdown and reports the Taoiseach urging people to be vigilant about personal behaviour. The Irish Examiner leads with another comment by Micheál Martin that younger age groups should be given the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to ensure that no injections go to waste or are held in reserve. The Irish Independent reckons that around 200,000 people aged 45 to 49 could be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 in June if the Health Service Executive gets the go-ahead to change restrictions on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In other stories on the front pages, in the Examiner, Noel Baker reports that at least 514 people have been reinfected with COVID here since the pandemic began. Figures from the Department of Health show that some reinfections were barely 3 months apart, he writes. 15 years after a sectarian attack in Ballymena, County Antrim, in which 15-year-old Michael McElveen was killed, a new witness has come forward to claim that one of his killers confessed to a knife having been used. So Maeve Connolly reports in the Irish News lead story. The Times reports on the difficulties of the British Labour Party following its poor showing in last week's elections. Dennis Staunton writes that the party leader, Keir Starmer, turned a setback into a crisis when he sought to scapegoat deputy leader Angela Rayner for the party's losses in England. He sacked her as party chair, just as some of Labour's best results were coming through, says Staunton. John Downing, in a comment piece in The Independent, writes that there are five key messages to Ireland from the elections in Scotland, England and Wales. The first is that Ireland needs to pay more attention to relations with Scotland and Wales. Another is that the prospect of Scottish independence has taken another step forward, with huge implications for Northern Ireland. The leadership contest in the Ulster Unionist Party is the main story for the Belfast Telegraph. Expected to throw their hats in the ring today, the paper says, are Doug Beattie, an army veteran, and Robbie Butler, a former firefighter.
It's been the longest 4 and a bit months, a cold, cold spring after a very dark winter. But today there is light. After 150 plus days of lockdown, we can perhaps begin to hope that things are getting better. Grandparents can hug their children and grandchildren again for the first time in 14 months. Many haven't even seen each other in that time. Three people who are vaccinated can meet for cuppas and chats inside. We can welcome six people or three households to our gardens again. And for the shops, which are the backbone of our economy and who have put their blood, sweat and tears into their businesses, they can open their shutters again from today. The Grizzly Adams look is no more. Hairdressers and personal services are open. Thousands of other shops are too, for click and collect, and open fully again from next Monday. Our libraries, museums, galleries will have people inside again. Churches, synagogues and mosques will welcome their faithful back. Up to 15 people can train outside. Well, throughout the programme, we will hear from people across all of these groups who are fervently hoping that this is the beginning of the end, all the while remembering the 7,068 people on the island who have paid the ultimate price. We're joined this morning by Mairead Owens, who is Dublin City Librarian, Ian Madden, CrossFit Trainer in Greystones in County Wicklow, and Father Pat O'Donnell, Parish Priest and of Rathmore in County Kerry. You're all very welcome and good morning to you. Mairead, I'll start with you. How are you feeling this morning?
Oh, good morning, Rachel. Really excited. Counting down the hours at this stage now to 10 o'clock and so nice to be actually able to physically welcome people back into the library spaces in the next few hours.
Ian, what about you?
He's not there now.
Ian, are you there?
No, he's not there.
He's not there. And Father Pat, what about you? How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm delighted. It's great to welcome people back because, you know, we, like in every form of life, we've missed them. And they've missed the gathering because that's at the heart of what we are as church, people gathering together. And, you know, I'm sure like in your own lives, Zoom meetings were great and they had their value. But there's nothing like meeting people and being with people.
Absolutely. And Pat, for you to have people in your church again and not just for funerals.
Oh, yeah. You know, you hit the nail on the head there. For our ministry, for the last few months, it's been really our contact with people has been totally with funerals. And it's a valuable time. But, you know, at a human level, too, you just need the variety. But I must say, through streaming, we had lots of contact with people. But again, it's not the same.
Mairead, will you take us through what we can do in our libraries from today?
Sure. I mean, the local authorities now are desperately trying to breathe life back into local communities all over the whole country. So from Donegal down to Cork, Galway to Dublin, the libraries will open at about 10 o'clock this morning and the public will be welcomed in to browse. So they can come in and choose a book, DVD, CD. We would ask them not to stay too long and then they leave. Hopefully over the next few weeks then, you know, as more people are vaccinated and we build up a confidence, we may be able to increase service. But at the moment, it's literally returning and borrowing items from their local library, but also doing the online digital content that we've been doing during the during COVID.
Well, we are joined now by Ian Madden, Ian's CrossFit trainer in Greystones in Wicklow. Ian, how are you feeling this morning?
Good, yeah. Look, it's great to be back. It's finally great to be back open in some kind of fashion. We're working around kind of maybe at half capacity an outdoor facility at the moment, but all going well, we should be back in by June 7th.
Great stuff. So what will you be doing today with your customers, your clients?
Well, we've had to set up sort of individualized training sessions. So the way it's worked out is we have to kind of have individualized equipment, individualized space and cleaning stations. So what we're going to do is see a return to kind of some sort of training that's a little bit better than what we've been doing online.
Because I presume the people who you work with, Ian, need a lot of motivation to keep at what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen a big fall off during this last 12 weeks. I think people had really grown fed up with the online situation. So, yeah, we've seen a huge fall off in the last 12 weeks in terms of people's attitude towards training online, and I think there's a big appetite to get back inside the building, you know.
And Father Pat, you've been here before in the sense that churches were open before the lockdown again in December. Are you confident that things can get back safely?
Oh yeah, I really am, and because our systems are in place and there's a huge level of volunteers that ensure that people are safe. And I think that's what gave people confidence, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just think the increase in the number of going to funerals is going to be huge because, ironically, you know, we celebrate, as you mentioned at the start, parents and grandkids being able to get together. But when it was down to 10, it was the grandkids were left outside the door. So in a way, they were separated in life and death. And that's going to be huge, huge for people.
Yeah, the numbers go up to 50 from today for funerals and weddings, which mm-hmm. is a substantial increase.
Oh, yeah.
And communions and confirmations, though, they still can't happen.
Yeah, and not at present. And I suppose at present would mean whenever the health authorities deem that can happen. So I'd say in a lot of cases it will go out until the autumn. But again, yeah, that creates a backlog in the autumn when all the weddings that were cancelled, when everything, baptisms, our communions and everything. So we don't think too much ahead until September from a work point of view.
Mairead, from your point of view as a librarian, I mean, people have been very patient and you all have been very patient and have been through an awful time over the last year and a bit. You must be looking forward to just getting new books out on the shelves.
Oh, you've no idea, Rachel. I mean, we've been buying new books. We start in January every year. So certainly from Dublin, we have an amazing collection out in Cabra with the vans all, I suppose, loaded up and ready to go. So the deliveries will start this morning. Now, we have been, as I said, doing the online service. So people have been able to borrow online, you know, e-books and audiobooks and reading magazines. But I think at this stage, a bit like Ian and Pat are saying, you know, people are tired of Zoom. They want something other than the, you know, the digital content. And nothing beats the physicality of holding a book or a storybook in your hand and the smell of a new book, which I'm looking forward to myself. So, yeah, good and ready to go, absolutely.
And Ian, do you dare to hope that this is the beginning of the end, that once you get back up and running today and then from next month to resume indoor training individually, that there's no going back?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't think there's even an option at this stage to go backwards because the last figures we looked at, 66% of the nation were encroaching on a level of obesity, and I think mental health is really suffering, and I think exercise and fitness is really, really going to be important to the health of the nation. So what we, I suppose, would like to see is not only a return to fitness, but also maybe a recognition from the government that it how important it is for the health of the nation, and maybe we could be reclassified as an essential service, you know.
And from a financial point of view, Ian, was the last year and a bit very hard?
It was, yeah, because we were stuck in the middle. A lot of industries that were closed entirely were getting grant funding. But with the fitness industry servicing online, we saw maybe a 50% fall off in revenue, which essentially wasn't enough to put us into the category of grant funding. So, yeah, it's been a struggle. It's been a real struggle to meet bills and also to incentivize staff to stay on. A lot of staff in the fitness industry have moved to other industries in search of work. So people who couldn't wait, people with families, have moved to maybe working in a Lidl or working in a Tesco. So there'll be big challenges for us to get staff to return, and I'm sure there'll be big challenges for gyms in terms of reopening costs, you know.
Well, look, good luck to you all today and enjoy the day. And thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning. That's Ian Madden, CrossFit trainer in Greystones, Mairead Owens, Dublin City librarian, and Father Pat O'Donnell, parish priest of Rathmore in County Kerry.
So what should happen with intercounty travel along the border? The Irish government says intercounty includes Northern Ireland. However, Northern Ireland's Health Minister Robin Swan says non-essential cross-border travel should be stopped by enforcement if necessary. Pádraig McLoughlin, Sinn Féin TD for Donegal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mary.
Do you agree with Robin Swan, the Northern Ireland Health Minister, when he says that crossing the border for non-essential or socialising purposes creates an unnecessary risk of virus spread?
No, I don't agree with him because of the phase of this crisis that we're now at. You know, clearly we've made progress across the island with the vaccination programme over recent weeks. And, you know, if you look at the advice from NFET, they are stating clearly that we should give people a phased reopening, that, you know, intercounty travel is reinstated today, obviously going to hairdressers, barbers, appointments in local retail are all agreeable. And people have to have hope. They have to, you know, see progress for all of the sacrifice that they have made. So certainly, I believe across the island of Ireland, people should be able to avail of intercounty travel, but to do it responsibly in line with public health requests on both sides of the border.
And that is the key issue, isn't it? Doing it responsibly, because Robin Swan makes the point that Northern Ireland has outpaced the Republic on the vaccine rollout so far, and indeed on the lifting of restrictions as well. But that adds to the concerns. So, you know, he has written to Stephen Donnelly, the Health Minister here, seeking meetings and seeking their response. Short of enforcement, though, short of that being introduced, what other measures could be used?
Well, what I would be saying to people around the border area is that the businesses in their local communities have suffered, you know, terribly over the last, you know, 14 months. and particularly again in the last 4 months. And I would say to people, if they can hold back on that retail shopping they're waiting to do for another couple of weeks, indeed they can do it by appointment today, I would ask them to do that, to shop locally, to not be going in large numbers into the north, for example. I mean, there may be shopping that they've held back on, they, you know, it could be like children's clothes or whatever it might be. But overall, I think people don't need to be going in large numbers for that type of reason. But we do need to know that within the border communities, and obviously I live in the border myself, I mean, you know, we are integrated. There are large numbers of people who travel cross-border for essential reasons like work every single day. And we need to now break down that border and allow people, and of course people from the north coming into Donegal, to walk on the beach and so on. We need to allow that type of normal behaviour to come back into place.
And I know you and people in Donegal were annoyed and upset at the CMO's comments about activities in Donegal and breaches of COVID restrictions. How are things there now? Is the phone line working, the dedicated Garda phone line for reporting? Are the walk-in centres working? Is there evidence of a reduction in these types of activities? And this was partying and large gatherings.
Well, there was huge anger in Donegal because the vast majority of people in Donegal have made the, you know, sacrifices, have adhered to the public health guidelines. I mean, the numbers in Donegal only a short few months ago were 1,600 per 100,000. We got that down to about 150. It went up in a number of electoral areas, I think about two, and now it's coming back down again. So, like, we're confident in Donegal that we're moving out of this crisis. Today, obviously, we can avail of inter-county travel, all of the other benefits that everybody else across the island are enjoying. And I mean, certainly we have said we would like to see more vaccination centres, more test centres. That is starting to happen, and we welcome that. But in Donegal, the numbers are going in the right direction again, and hopefully it'll stay that way.
But your message is, and Thomas Byrne, Fianna Fáil was saying it yesterday, it's don't be going like the clappers across the border.
We're saying to people that certainly they have, you know, after all the sacrifices that they have made, we want to try and reinstate, you know, phase back in normality. People have to have hope, you know, and they're looking at the news, they're seeing the vaccination numbers going in the right direction. So you need to have a life being, you know, brought back into place. But to be responsible with that, of course, that, you know, if you look at the advice Menfet, just in this state alone, that's the message they're saying. You know, avail of the new opportunities that comes with the opening up of society, but be responsible with it.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining us. That's Pádraic McLoughlin, Sinn Féin TD for Donegal.
Lidl say they sold 10,000 antigen tests on the first day last week. A pack of five cost $24.99 in the supermarket, but Neffet isn't happy. The chief medical officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, said he was concerned that the kits represented a real risk to the country's response to COVID. Is he right, or is it just similar to Neffet's original reaction to the wearing of face masks last year, when it originally warned against them before telling people to wear them? We're joined now by Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College. Professor Mills, first of all, what is an antigen?
Good morning, Audrey. Yes, to explain to listeners what an antigen test is, it's a form of rapid testing which can be completed in as little time as 15 minutes, and a person can do them themselves. And that's very different from the PCR testing people hear about, which is the routine method for diagnosing COVID-19. PCR is extremely sensitive, but it's sophisticated and requires you know, a lot of equipment and time, and it can take up to 24 hours to complete, and sometimes longer even to report on it, whereas rapid testing can be completed, as I said, within 15 minutes, and the person can do it themselves, or it can be done by a trained person, and it detects the protein from the virus rather than the nucleic acid, which the PCR test does. Now, the issue with it is that it's not as sensitive as PCR testing, therefore it can miss some cases, but if done more frequently enough, especially when the person has a high virus load, then it can detect the virus. In fact, one of the issues with PCR testing is it can be too sensitive, and after a person is no longer infectious, they can still turn up positive. So there's huge benefits to the antigen testing as an adjunct to PCR testing.
So would you be in favour of them, or would you have the concerns that Tony Houlihan has?
I'm very much in favour of them. I mean, the group that I was on that Mark Ferguson chaired, you know, endorsed their use in many settings, in particular in businesses, schools, universities, as a means of testing people maybe two or three times a week for safe return to work or activity. You know, there's been lots of pilot studies done in the UK where they're using them in schools, where they've tested them as an alternative to quarantine. A person could testing once a day for 5 days rather than quarantine. In the UK, 190,000 people are having to quarantine each week, which takes them out of work for up to 10 days. Whereas with self-testing, they test themselves every day and they can still go to work, and if they're positive, then they go and they get a PCR test. So it's a huge advantage. Also, the US are now considering using them for instead of quarantine for travel. Mm-hmm. So these are really getting traction in a lot of countries. Even in Ireland, they've been used by the HSC for testing in the meat processing plants. And HICWA had a report about 7 days ago showing that they were very effective in that setting. Mm-hmm. I think the settings of mass testing is a little different. The UK are gone down that route as well, and they've put billions of euros into this program called Moonshot, which is mass testing of the public. And I think we're a little off doing that here, but I'd certainly like to see them being used more in businesses and schools than the
method of doing the test, Kingston, it's like the PCR test. You have to put a swab into your own nose, into your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, the difference is that the PCR test is done what's called a nasopharyngeal swab, which is a swab that's pushed down the back of your nose, quite uncomfortable.
Well, it's very
and
uncomfortable.
It can only be done by a trained person. Whereas the testing for the antigen can either be done in saliva, just by spitting into a tube, or by what's called an anterior or mid-turbinate swab, which is the person shoves a swab themselves up into their nose, but not right down the back, just rubs it around and then puts it into some liquid medium.
And is it okay to do that on your nose, on your nasal passages, maybe two or three times a week?
Yeah, it's just like putting a cottonwood bud in your nose, so it's not invasive at all, or taking a saliva sample is not.
And just on that question, invasive. If it is positive, how that feeds into public health then in terms of contact tracing and follow-up tests?
If the person is positive, then they have to go and get a regular PCR test to confirm that it's positive. One of the issues with these tests is that they're not as sensitive, and they sometimes also give false positives, but it's quite rare. I mean, the specificity is around 99.7%, but the sensitivity can be lower than 80%, or around 80% when done by a professional, but down to 50-60% when done themselves, especially if the person's not trained. And
okay.
The UK, what they're doing, the schools, the first two or three times somebody does this, they do it in the school, and then when they're trained how to do it, they do it at home, and in that way they're much more effective.
All right. Well, thank you very much indeed for explaining all of that for us this morning. Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 7:36, it's good morning to Darren Frahill.
And a good morning to you as well, Audrey. And it's going to be a very good morning for Rory McIlroy when he wakes up in America this morning. He ended his long, winless run at the Wells Fargo Championship last night, won this event for a third time. He finished with a 68, won it on 10 under by a shot, and it's his first victory since November 2019. And the timing couldn't be better because it comes ahead of the USPGA Championship, the second major of the year, which takes place the week after next. Had a little obstacle to get over on the 18th. His drive found trouble near a stream. His caddy, Harry Diamond, encouraged Rory to take a drop, which he did. And from there, he found the green with an 8-iron, two-putted out for the title. Rory paid tribute to his caddy and friend afterwards.
You know, Harry was awesome out there today, especially that decision on the last. I was ready to get in there and try to play that with a lob wedge, and he just sort of was like, "Whoa, just let's take a step back. Let's think about this. Where's the best place you're hitting your third from?" You know, he sort of calmed me down and slowed me down a little bit and said, "Pal, let's just think about this a little bit." And ultimately, we made the right decision, and I dropped instead of trying to play that shot out of the hazard. And had a great third shot onto the green and was able to two-putt from there. So, but this is Harry and I's sixth win together, and it's probably been our best one. The tough parts that I've sort of had to endure over the last few months. You know, he's been with me every step of the way, and you know, it's nice to come through all that with him and to get into the winner's circle again.
More from Rory in the next hour. Garrick Higo won the Canary Islands Championship on 27 under par. Brilliant performance though from Niall Carney. He had a final round 61, finished in a tie for fourth place on 10 under, his best ever finish on the European Tour. Unfortunately, Great Britain and Ireland lost to the USA 14-12 in the Walker Cup last night. Hard fought battle, great golf by two Irish players, Mark Power and John Murphy, over the weekend, but both lost their single matches last night. Now, the new GAA season got up and running over the weekend with the first round of the Allianz Hurling League. Result of the weekend went to Antrim. They marked their return to Division 1 with a two-point victory against Clare at Corrigan Park. Cork scored 5 goals in their 7-point win over Waterford, and Wexford were too strong for Laois. They ran out 19-point winners. But the performance by Cork's hurlers caught many people's eye. Manager Kieran Kingston pleased, but not getting carried away.
I think the scoreline flattered us, being honest. I think the scoreline flattered us today. Waterford were missing a lot of big names, so we realised that coming into the game. But look, from our perspective, was get the first game under our belt, get the cobwebs out of the system, take it for two or three games to see where we're really at, try and build a bit of momentum during the league, and trying to build maybe our panel for championship. And that's really what this is about, you know. From our perspective, obviously, we're happy with the win. Thought we were very sloppy at times during the first half in particular, and that's understandable, I suppose, after such a long layoff. And again, and coming down the stretch, again, we thought we got very complacent and sloppy, and that was disappointing from our perspective.
And now a nice handy one for you on Saturday next against Tip.
Yeah, always is handy above in Turles, isn't it?
Absolutely. The new sin bin rule seemed to go pretty smoothly over the weekend, but the big talking points surrounded the new advantage rule. Many felt the meeting of Limerick and Tipperary was very stop-start on Saturday evening, and as a result of the number of frees being awarded. Wexford manager Davy Fitzgerald among them.
The most important thing for me is the game is allowed to flow, right? If there's a clear-cut goal chance, then I agree with that. That has to be punished, right? But the most important thing to me is keep the game flowing. I don't want to see a game with 40-plus frees in it. And maybe the heads of Croke Park mightn't agree with that, but if they have a game with 40-plus frees in it, it's going to be an absolute disaster for people to watch. And that's the truth about it. It's a manly game. Let's get out there and play it. If there's something blatant that'll affect it, and there definitely was stuff last year that could have made a difference bearing down in goals. You can't just grab on someone and it might happen to us. We might do it and we'll be punished for it the same as anybody else. But I actually don't think that's a bad thing, that particular one.
More on that later. West Brom have been relegated from the Premier League, lost 3-1 to Arsenal. West Ham suffered a setback in their hopes of qualifying for the Champions League. They lost 1-0 to Everton, and Manchester United beat Aston Villa 3-1. Wolves came from behind to beat Brighton 2-1. Shelburne beat Treaty 5-0 in the SSE Electricity League. That's in the women's competition. Sam Bennett claimed the green jersey at the 5-day tour of the Algarve. Aidan O'Brien's Balshaw Ballet won the Derrinstown Stud Derby Trial Stakes. And finally, Lewis Hamilton won the Spanish Grand Prix. I'm back with more sport after the news at 8:30.
We're going to return to this morning's good news story as thousands of businesses finally reopen to customers. It's a good day for customers and for those retailers and service businesses who are finally getting up and running. However, for some, is it already too late? Richard Guiney is Chief Executive of the Dublin Town Business Umbrella Group. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Is a good morning for Dublin and for the other towns and cities around the country, with, you know, traders and customers reclaiming the streets, I suppose, from the foxes and the tumbleweed. What are you hoping for in Dublin?
Well, today, as you know, we will have a partial reopening, which is very welcome. So obviously we'll have click and collect and retail by appointment and the return of personal services. Obviously next week that'll ramp up a lot. And then obviously in June we'll have outdoor dining. So, you know, we're very pleased to be making the first steps. You know, a lot of these businesses have been closed since Christmas, so and they're financially fragile and vulnerable. So I think there's a kind of a sense of relief to be back trading, albeit somewhat limited today.
How fragile and how vulnerable are some of these businesses? You conducted a survey on Henry Street, didn't you? Tell us about it.
Yeah, look, the bottom line is that we knew that retail was going to change, and we thought we probably would have about a 10-year gap to make the appropriate interventions. So, you know, people are buying less. That's just a reality. They're spending more money on experiences rather than material goods. And the larger floor plate stores, that model was most vulnerable because, you know, their selling point was that they had a lot of stock and, you know, you could get whatever you wanted. But, you know, they were more vulnerable to changes with the internet and online sales, etc. So unfortunately, you know, a lot of the large international chains have actually pulled out. We all know the names of those that have gone. But, you know, the likes of Henry Street is very vulnerable to those changes. And we will have a high level of vacancy. So putting it in context, at the peak of the recession, about 10 years ago, we had a vacancy rate across the city of, you know, 15.5%. We have roughly double that on some of the prime streets, you know, and that is a real concern in terms of, you know, maintaining a level of trade. Now, we know that there's pent-up savings. We know that people want to get back to the city. So, you know, we can turn this around, but we need very urgent interventions to make sure that we have a city that functions into the future.
You're saying as high as 30% on some of the main streets of our capital city. And are you worried as well? Because people are still being advised to work from home where possible. So it's likely you won't have the footfall you might anticipate for the restaurants, the cafes, the bars, and even for those impulsive purchases that people might make on their lunch break or at the end of the day.
Yeah, look, you know, that's very true. You know, at Christmas we had a footfall, which was about 3/4 of what it would have been in 2019. But for the rest of the periods when we were open, it ranged between 45 and less than 60%. So we do have some businesses that are on a wait and see and deciding whether or not they'll actually commence trading. But I think we need some policy interventions here. In terms of public transport, capping that at 50%, that needs to be looked at. 2/3 of our customers come in by public transport. You've mentioned the return to the office. You know, we certainly noticed that midweek our footfall was way down compared to weekends when we were open last year. We need our office workers, but, you know, the office workers need us too. What we really noticed in the last year was the symbiosis and the integration of the economy. And I think, you know, the focus has been very much on encouraging remote working. But a lot of office managers want their staff back, okay, even on a temporary basis. So if we can get them back 3 days a week, that could save the city.
All right.
But I think we need to look at those issues.
OK, Tánaiste Éan Minister for Enterprise, Leo Varadkar, is with us after eight. For now, Richard Guiney of Dublin Town. Thank you.
The supermarket Lidl say they sold 10,000 of the kits on their first day of sale last week. We'll speak to its chief executive in a minute. But first, here's the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan's response to what Lidl is doing.
And we think antigen testing has a role to play in the response to the pandemic, but in strictly controlled circumstances where we know that the test is going to work, we understand what the result means, and that its performance is not going to lead to the performance of the test now, is not going to lead to individuals getting inappropriate reassurance, feeling that they're safe when they're not, undertaking activities they shouldn't be, and then putting other people at risk. And we're really concerned about that. And just to give you a practical example, in a situation where it is easily available to people to go and buy antigen tests, we're concerned that somebody could go into a supermarket and buy, for example, you know, a pound of sausages and charcoal for a barbecue and an antigen test and think, great, and they don't have to take the restrictions. And that represents a real risk to our pandemic response.
Dr. Tony Houlihan. Well, the CEO of Lidl is JP Scally. He's on the line now. Mr. Scally, is that a fair point from Dr. Houlihan, that last point there, sausages, charcoal and antigens, and think I'm okay with the rest of the restrictions?
Good morning, Audrey. I think first thing to note is that, you know, the Irish public have been really compliant since the onset of the pandemic with any of the restrictions that were issued by NPHET or by government. People were very compliant generally, and that has seen us, I suppose, have quite a successful response to the pandemic overall. I don't see this being any different. I think antigen tests, as we heard earlier from Professor Kingston Mills, have a very important role to play. And we have to trust our customers and the public that they'll use them appropriately and continue to take all the necessary public health measures along with the antigen tests. And we're quite confident that our customers will do that.
How many have you sold now?
We put them on sale just on Friday morning at a retail price of €24.99 for five tests, so €5 per test. And we had huge demand. So on the first day alone, we sold 10,000 test kits, so the equivalent of 50,000 tests. And sales have continued to be strong over the weekend. We're actually out of stock in a number of stores as of this morning, but we're working hard to get additional stock back on sale.
Is that quite the markup, $24.99 for five? I mean, these aren't expensive kits to produce.
They're actually the most competitive on the market by a long shot. So, you know, people have been using antigen tests for since last summer, really, in the country. I think that's important also to bear in mind. But people are buying them online. And, you know, we've heard stories of people paying up to €100, €150 per test. So I think comparatively, our tests at €5 are very, very competitive. I think the cheapest currently on sale in the market elsewhere is at about €10 to €12 per test. So we're less than half the price of what's on sale anywhere else.
And do your staff take them?
They do. So how this came about actually was with the introduction of tests to our staff about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So we were delighted to be able to secure some stock for our colleagues. And since then, they've been taking them once per week. And the reaction from our staff has been really, really positive. They were delighted that this added to the level of security that we already had in place for them with all of the other measures, the protective screens, the hand sanitizer, the masks, etc. So the uptake from our staff has been really, really positive. And, you know, we already have one example in our workforce of a colleague who tested positive with one of these antigen tests, removed himself immediately from the workplace, spoke to his GP, got a PCR test completed, which confirmed he was positive, and thankfully then was able to get early detection and remove himself from the workplace before there was any further issues.
Okay, so in your mind, you're just providing a service, you're providing a product for sale, and it's personal responsibility that still has to take place.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we have to trust the public. The public, as I say, have been fantastic in their response to the pandemic to date. We see that in our stores. 99% of our customers follow all of the guidelines. They use the hand sanitizer. They keep their distance. They're respectful. I think this will be no different. People will purchase them now at an affordable price of €5 per test, and then they'll continue to follow all of the other public health guidelines as well.
Thank you very much indeed, JP Scally, CEO of Lidl.
Funding to Irish tech firms rose by almost 9% in the first 3 months of the year, according to the Irish Venture Capital Association. More than €249 million was raised by firms here in the first quarter. That's according to its Venture Pulse survey conducted with William Fry. That compares to less than €229 million in the same period of 2020. Sarah-Jane Larkin is Director General of the IVCA, and she joins me on the line now. Sarah-Jane, on that overall figure first, funding rose last year, despite that challenging environment. It's up again at the start of this year. How have tech firms managed to avoid being impacted by the pandemic when they're looking for funding?
Good morning, Adam. Our funding was up last year, and what we noticed last year was a trend that a lot of the funding was going to more established companies, and they were larger fundraising rounds to those well-established companies. What we are seeing this year is a particularly welcome recovery at early stage. So some of the early stage companies that didn't get funding last year, the funding there was down by about a third. So I think the reason for that is last year, a lot of venture capital funds made sure that their existing portfolio companies had enough runway for maybe 24 months to see them through the pandemic and invested to make sure that they had. Whereas this year, we're starting to see a rebound and a very welcome rebound in the early stage of funding, with companies that are raising less than 1 million. Fundraising there is up by 53%. And I think, you know, part of the reason for that rebound is that we're starting to see some of the government supports through Enterprise Ireland and ISIF have a real impact in the market.
There was a lot of concern expressed about the fall in early stage funding last year. And as you say, it's back up in the early start of this year. Is it too early to breathe a sigh of relief?
I think we've had a very vibrant and resilient sector here for the last number of years. I think this trend is really positive. And what I would say is that we almost need to double down now. We have a limited pool of natural resources in this country. And I think if we look at the startup sector, you know, we need to recognise what a significant driver of economic growth it can be. Post-pandemic, you know, I think we can all anticipate that there will be a golden age for tech innovation. And I think the funding, you know, both last year and this year is really showing that Irish startups can, you know, can take a significant part in driving Irish economic growth into the future.
Why is it so important to see early stage funding bounce back, and is it bouncing back at enough of a rate to make up for what was lost last year?
So I think, you know, if you think about funding at all stages, we report at different deal stages, you can almost think of it like a relay race where the early investors, you know, invest small amounts of money and take the baton on, and those companies then, you know, raise larger rounds as they scale and grow. And, you know, I think the downturn last year at the early stage and the drop of a third, what it simply meant was those companies, you know, if a third less companies achieved funding at the early stage, there would then be a third less companies in maybe 5 years' time to raise the bigger rounds and scale and grow.
A separate survey today shows the majority of CEOs here planning a major transformation in the next year. Could the funding that we've seen in the past year or so be part of that, maybe the pandemic pushing firms to reorientate their businesses completely?
Yeah, you know, I think we all know that the digital transformation has accelerated over the last year. You know, it's taken a jump forward about 10 years in the last 12 months. And I think, you know, one of the other things that was reported recently was the increase in household savings, which were up by about 16 billion last year. And, you know, I think we're all aware that we have a property investment culture in Ireland. And I think what these findings show is we really need now to build an equity investment culture here and take measures that will help build that culture. And I think the success of crowdfunding over the last couple of years shows that there is a real appetite for smaller investors to participate. And some of the reforms that are being discussed at the moment, like the EIIS, you know, I think that, you know, gives an opportunity to make investing much more accessible for a wider group of people and really help Irish SMEs to drive on and be an engine of economic growth.
Okay, Sarah Jane Larkin, Director General of the IVCA, thank you very much for that.
The Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, got his first shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine from the HSE Assistant Director of Nursing, Brenda Dillon, in Cork City Hall yesterday. And there are pictures on the front pages of the Irish Times, Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror and Irish Sun to prove it. "It's great to be vac," says the headline in the Mirror, picking up on the lockdown easing today. And the Taoiseach's prediction that we're set to have a good summer if we can keep this progress going. "Top jab," says the Sun. The Times describes a major relaxing today of COVID-19 restrictions after 5 months of strict lockdown and reports the Taoiseach urging people to be vigilant about personal behaviour. The Irish Examiner leads with another comment by Micheál Martin that younger age groups should be given the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to ensure that no injections go to waste or are held in reserve. The Irish Independent reckons that around 200,000 people aged 45 to 49 could be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 in June if the Health Service Executive gets the go-ahead to change restrictions on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In other stories on the front pages, in the Examiner, Noel Baker reports that at least 514 people have been reinfected with COVID here since the pandemic began. The Times reports on the difficulties of the British Labour Party following its poor showing in last week's elections. Dennis Staunton writes that the party leader, Keir Starmer, turned a setback into a crisis when he sought to scapegoat Deputy Leader Angela Rayner for the party's losses in England. He sacked her as party chair, just as some of Labour's best results were coming through, says Staunton. John Downing, in a comment piece in The Independent, writes that one message from the elections is that Ireland needs to pay more attention to relations with Scotland and Wales. Another is that the prospect of Scottish independence has taken another step forward, with huge implications for Northern Ireland. The leadership contest in the Ulster Unionist Party is the main story for the Belfast Telegraph. Expected to throw their hats in the ring today, the paper says, are Doug Beattie, an army veteran, and Robbie Butler, a former firefighter. In an opinion column in the Examiner, Terry Prone takes the opportunity of Owen Harris's dismissal as an opinion columnist in the Sunday Independent to outline her negative view of him over 50 years and to wonder why nobody stopped him until now. The Times reports that Gardaí have confirmed that they are investigating the alleged online harassment of a female journalist through Twitter. Conor Gallagher writes that some of the content at the centre of the criminal complaint came from a now suspended anti-Sinn Féin account under the name Barbara J. Pym, which was used by Owen Harris. The complaint was made on behalf of Irish Examiner political correspondent Aoife Moore by her employer, The Times says. And it was made before it was known that Mr. Harris was one of the Twitter account users. In The Independent, meanwhile, Conor Fian reports that up to 9 accounts linked to the Barbara J. Pym account have also been suspended. The latest one, called Northern Whig, was suspended yesterday. As for the real Barbara Pym, her name has been taken in vain, according to a reader's letter in The Examiner. Catherine Barrett from County Cork writes that Ms. Pym, after serving her country in the Second World War, wrote a series of excellent novels, which gave joy to very many people. Ms. Barrett hopes that Ms. Pym's estate will take steps to ensure that the writer's name is not used again as a cover for those who, for whatever reason, do not wish to use their own.
You're welcome back to Morning Ireland. It's 11 minutes past 8. And Tánaiste Leo Varadkar, you're welcome to the programme.
Morning.
Now, I know it's a showery and wet day, but there's a sunny mood about today as businesses start to reopen and you have up to 270,000 people getting their vaccination this week. How are you approaching this reopening? Is it a mix of hope and caution?
Yes, but I think today is also a day of freedom. People can travel freely anywhere on the island. We can meet our friends and family outdoors, indoors if we're vaccinated. Religious services are back, which is very important to people of faith. And from my point of view as Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, we expect to see across the course of the week about 12,000 businesses reopen for the first time this year, and maybe as many as 100,000 people going back to work. So what I'd say really is thank you. Thank you to the Irish people for getting us this far. Thank you to the HSE for running such a good vaccination programme. And also thank you to Irish business, because they've had to make enormous sacrifices over the past few months. And I just want everyone who's in business to know that the government is going to be there to continue to support you financially, to give you a chance to bounce back after a really difficult year of trading.
And they'll be glad to hear that. But what does that mean? You're going to be there and you're going to continue to give them financial support?
Yeah, well it means that the existing financial supports will remain exactly as they are, at least until the end of June. And by the end of May, by the end of this month, we'll give business certainty and clarity about what happens thereafter.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your thinking around that? Because we've heard you say before there won't be a cliff edge, you and other ministers. But what is your thinking about how you are going to continue to give some form of financial assistance to some of the businesses that are teetering on the brink?
Yeah, so there'll be a number of things. No cliff edge, as you say, but also this can't go on forever. This is borrowed money, so we'll have to be phased out over time. We will make a distinction, obviously, between firms and sectors that are still closed or suffering the most, as opposed to those that will be able to bounce back quite quickly once they're up and running. But things, for example, like the wage subsidy scheme, probably the most important individual action for business, we'd anticipate that staying in place for some time.
At the level that it's at?
At the moment, you have to, your turnover has to be down by 30% or more to qualify. You know, that may change, but it'll certainly remain in place for companies that have seen a very significant turnover. But like I say, those decisions aren't actually made yet. They won't be made until the end the month. So
you'll have to make decisions as well, Tánaiste, won't you, on the PUP payment? Because self-employed people, I think, in some cases have been able to earn up to close to €1,000 even while still going back to work and doing some work.
Yeah, that's right. But we will make those decisions cautiously. You know, we're conscious that even though businesses may be able to reopen, even though self-employed people can operate their businesses or professions again, it's going to take time for people to actually bounce back, to build up some cash reserves, to pay off some debts. And, you know, things like commercial rates for the third quarter, we're going to have to examine them. Things like tax warehousing, which has been very important for people as well in terms of cash flow. You know, all of those things are being examined at the moment. The VAT rate for the tourism and hospitality sector, that stays at 9% until the end of the year. We'll look at whether we need to extend that into next year as well. So anything that we do is going to be done in a graduated way, recognising the fact that people have suffered a lot. And one thing we don't want to do is withdraw the financial supports too quickly, because we do think there will be a boom in consumer spending now that people are allowed to spend again over the next few months. But that could actually tail off in the autumn. And the last thing we want to do is to be removing government support at the same time as demand falls off. And that's where it's actually at that point the businesses might get into trouble.
And that's a worry I've heard some business owners express already, that you will have the initial return with large numbers, but then, it'll peter out a bit again. What about businesses, though, that won't reopen? And we heard Richard Guiney from Dublin Town talking, you know, quite worryingly about how the retail sector is going to evolve. Up to 30% 30% down on occupancy rates in the main streets of our capital city.
Yeah, like Henry Street would be one of those, for example. And this is something we're going to have to grasp. Retail was changing anyway. It was going online, and the pandemic has very much accelerated that. It's not that there won't be bricks and mortar retail anymore, but there will be less of it. And I had a very good discussion with Mandate, the union in this area, only last week. And you know, the kind of things we're going to need to look at, for example, is training funds and transition funds for some of the workers in that sector, so that they can get new jobs in that sector or other sectors. That's going to be really important too. Another thing is how we can reuse some of those main street buildings for other uses. Perhaps.
Do I feel a task force coming on?
No. I think action more than a task force. But another thing as well we need to look at as well is the whole issue around businesses restructuring. And one thing we're going to get done before the summer recess, this is led by Minister Robert Troy, is a new examinership process. At the moment, if a business needs to restructure, it has to go through a very expensive examinership process through the High Court. And we're going to bring in a fast-track system of restructuring a business. So there may be businesses that actually could survive if they're able to restructure their debts.
Here's the other problem, we'll though, as outlined by Richard Guiney, which is, you're still saying to people, work from home where possible. You say about 100,000 people will be going back to work. But those people that would come into city centres and town centres, and they would keep the cafes going and the restaurants going and perhaps the bars after work, and they'd make the impulse buys in the shops, those people are not going to be there through June, July, August, September, perhaps on in towards Christmas. And that's a real problem for the retail sector and for the hospitality sector.
Yeah, it is. Now, it does depend on where you are. You know, footfall in the suburbs, for example, is up, and even in some rural towns and villages, because people are working from home. In the city centres, it's down dramatically. But I think that will come back, because we will see in July outdoor dining open, for example. I think people will be very enthusiastic about doing that. And it's really important that our city councils use streetscapes and use the space they have to facilitate that if they can. Probably going into the autumn, then you will see a return to the office in part and a return of inbound tourism. But things will never be the same again. You know, one thing that I'm very enthusiastic about is people having more flexibility about how they work, and this whole idea of blended working, where you might work in HQ or in the office 1 or 2 days a week, but you can also work from home or work from a remote hub. So, you know, when we talk about things going back to normal, it doesn't mean everything going back to normal. What we want to do is to go back to the things that we liked doing and maybe retain some of the things we learned that we also liked doing.
Well, let's talk about some of the help to allow us to go back to doing the things we liked doing. We'll talk about the vaccine rollout in a moment. But let's talk about antigen testing. Mm. You may have heard Kingston Mills earlier.
I missed him, unfortunately. He was
essentially outlining to Audrey the role that antigen testing can play. And we know the CMO was quite concerned about people going into the supermarket to pick up a pack of antigen tests along with their sausages and charcoal for the barbecue. What is the government thinking now on the wider use of antigen testing?
Yeah, so the government supports the wider use of antigen testing. We approved a report prepared by Professor Mark Ferguson, the Chief Scientific Officer, only a few weeks ago. And the way we see antigen testing is an additional health and safety measure. It's not a substitute for anything else, for masks or social distancing or isolating if you feel sick and getting a PCR test. It's an additional health and safety measure, and that's the way we should think of it. So we're doing pilots in schools, pilots in colleges could be really important in helping students back on campus in September and October. I know Minister Harris is very committed to that. From my side, we'll be producing new guidance within the next week or so for businesses to give them advice on how to use antigen tests.
They are being used, of course, in business already, aren't they? Fairly widely.
And yes, not as widely as we would like. So we're going to give them clear guidance as to what to do and what not to do, and encourage them to do more antigen testing. But I suppose to give you two sides of the coin, and Lidl, I think, is the example here. Lidl is offering all of its staff an antigen test every week, and I think that's a really good thing.
And the tests are flying off the shelves.
Yeah, but what they're also doing, though, is this ad, which I disagree with too. And it was an ad, you know, maybe it was a joke, but it was a bundle of charcoal sausages and an antigen test. And the message that sends out is that an antigen test is something you can take. It's negative. Now you've got the all clear, you know, go off and go to a barbecue, party, socialise. That's the wrong message. If an antigen test is positive, it means that you're infectious. You need to isolate. You need to get a confirmatory PCR test. If it's negative, it really means nothing. It certainly does not mean.
But can it provide people
visit your relatives and think it's all fine? It's not.
But can it provide people with, you know, like a belt and braces, that it is another tool in the armory, that it makes people maybe a little bit more confident? They've done everything right. They've followed all the rules. But if they're going to visit older relatives and so on, that it just gives them an added extra in their hope that they are staying as safe as they can.
Yeah, so long as it is belt and braces and keep the trousers on, not just belt or braces. And that's the worry I think people have, is that it could give people a sense of false reassurance.
Could you regulate such things in terms of sale?
Well, we could, but, you know, there are 16 tests that are approved by the European Commission. The others are not.
I think the test that Lidl is selling is approved, are approved.
Yeah, it's one approved. But you know, I suppose the scenario where we really want to use this is when you're doing a large number of antigen testing of a whole group of people. So say, for example, on a construction site or in a college, you don't just test one person and give that one person assurance. You test the whole group of people, and in that way you can pick out a few people who are infected, take them out of circulation and reduce the spread. And it's in outbreaks, it's in those kind of group scenarios that we should be using it, and using a lot more of it, and we intend to.
Would you pay for them? Would the government pay for them?
We are in some circumstances. We have been in the meat industry now for quite some time, and it's been helpful there. But by and large, when it comes to businesses, we're saying that they should pay for them themselves, but they are deductible from tax and as a business expense. Schools and colleges, we probably will, but that hasn't been worked out yet.
Okay. What about now the wider vaccine rollout we're seeing? Do you favour, I know the Taoiseach was talking about it yesterday, making the Johnson & Johnson vaccine available to the 45 to 50 cohort? NIAC is looking at it at the moment.
Yeah, so things going very well in the vaccine programme. I think the HSC has done a great job. We should be in a position to vaccinate about 250,000 people this week. The 2 millionth dose will be delivered at some stage this week. And what we want to avoid, though, is a scenario whereby we have vaccines in storage that we can't use. And that could arise in a few weeks' time. And that's what the Taoiseach is referring
to. With the Johnson, the big delivery arriving in June.
So it would make sense to me at that point if we had vaccines in storage that we couldn't use, that we would then offer them to people in their 40s. And in fairness to NIAC, in their advice, they actually suggest that it can be used in the under 50s if no other vaccine is available. So we're not at that point yet, but that's the logical thing to do.
Do you expect a decision from NIAC this week?
I don't know if there'll be one this week, but to be honest, it doesn't arise this week. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not in that position at the moment, but we are at the moment vaccinating people in their 60s, and we're allowing people in their 50s to book their appointment. And I'd really encourage people to do that. And it won't be long before we're offering appointments to people in their 40s as well.
Just the Minister for Health was on the This Week programme yesterday talking about, you know, there'll be an abundance of vaccine available in this country on towards the autumn. Millions of doses of vaccines. Vaccines that we may not need to use in this country. What are we going to do with them?
Well, I think if we get to the point where we have a surplus number of vaccines, there are other parts of the world that do need them. As I speak now, there are healthcare workers in the global south, in the developing world, who have not been vaccinated. We remember what that felt like in Ireland. And I think there does come a point, we're not there yet, where if we have surplus, that we should be willing to donate that to countries that need it. And a bit of that's done already through the European Union, particularly for the Balkans and what they call the European neighbourhood. But I think we're getting to the point that, you know, we need to consider that. And it would be a very important gesture of solidarity. But actually, it's in our interest too, because we're not safe from COVID until it's under control everywhere in the world.
A question to you on housing, which is, I'm sure you'd agree, the single biggest challenge after COVID that your government is facing. When and how are you going to address this issue now of investment funds buying up housing estates? And there were further revelations yesterday in the Sunday Business Post.
Yes, so we'd hope to come up with a solution, or we intend to come up with a solution to that in the next couple of weeks. I'm somebody who believes in home ownership. The government does too.
And you believe in investment funds and their role?
If the role is appropriate. If you look at it this way, we need to build about 350,000 new homes in Ireland over the next 10 years. That's a really big deal. It'll cost about 90 billion euros. The state can probably provide about a third of that in terms of investment in social housing and through the LDA and through NAMA and through HIBFI and all those vehicles, but we couldn't possibly provide it all. So, you know, trying to solve the housing crisis without the private sector, without private builders, without private finance is like trying to box with one hand behind your back. It's not possible.
So on this issue,
but we need to make sure it's appropriate. And what we want to do is use that money to invest in new builds, in new developments that wouldn't happen.
But how do you stop
How
do you stop a Maynooth happening again?
I don't know yet, but we are working up options, and there are options around tax, making the tax treatment of investment funds less favourable. And there are also options around the planning laws in limiting the number of purchases that any one entity could purchase.
It doesn't sound like we're going to get action anytime soon. And this is an important and urgent issue.
Oh, no, it will be soon. And it is an important and urgent issue. Within weeks.
Within weeks, yeah, there will be a development.
And it is, you know, it's. But we shouldn't forget what the overall problem here, and that is a lack of supply. And even when we remove the investment funds, you're still going to see first-time buyers and upgraders competing with the council, competing with affordable housing bodies.
But at least they'll be able to, if they feel, build communities that are invested in homes.
And I think if we're giving anyone advantage in this very tight market, it should be first-time buyers, not institutions of any form.
All right. Just a brief final question to you. Kate O'Connell, she will not be a Fine Gael candidate in Dublin Bay South in the by-election. She says her working relationship with you never recovered after she sided with Simon Coveney in the leadership race in Fine Gael. Did you show her a cold house in Fine Gael? Did you cut her out?
No. You know, Kate served one term in the Dáil. I think she was a very effective TD, very good on the referendum, very good on her committee work. But Fine Gael is a democratic party. Our candidates are selected by the members locally. This is a very strong constituency, 400 members, 12 branches. And on the day Eoghan Murphy stepped down from the Dáil, I made my position very clear that I wasn't going to be taking sides, that I'd put my 100% support behind whoever the grassroots, the activists selected. And Kate obviously has decided that she wouldn't be able to win that vote of local members.
She didn't feel she had your support, and she did come. She took the seat and then came close enough to retaining that seat, but she didn't feel she had your support this time.
The position that I took was that I wasn't taking sides. There are a lot of really good potential candidates in that constituency, and I took a position that as party leader I would allow the members to select the candidate, and unfortunately Kate felt that she didn't have the support of the local membership and decided not to put her name forward as a result of that. Nominations are still open, by the way. I'm sorry she took that decision, but that was a decision that she made herself.
Taoiseach Sally O'Varadkar, thank you for coming into us this morning.
And the COVID nightmare continues in India. Over 4,000 deaths each day over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of cases every day. As millions move out of the cities to smaller towns and villages, the virus is spreading. And in many of these places, there are no hospitals, no treatments, no tests. In the cities, hospitals are still struggling to find enough oxygen to help their patients. The international community is trying to help, but their supplies are taking a long time to arrive where they are most needed. Now, a Cork-based foundation, which runs a hospital in Kolkata, has been given €120,000 by the government here to help with their running costs. It is the Hope Foundation, and its logistics manager is Gora Das, who joins us now from Kolkata. Gora, thank you very much for joining us on Morning Ireland. How is your hospital coping?
Thank you, Audrey. Thanks for having me. Yeah, our hospital is right now converted into a COVID hospital with 50 beds, which is right now full with another 10 beds of additional isolation ward.
And do you have enough oxygen?
Yeah, for time being, thanks, because oxygen was a problem initially, but we had kind of encountered it. Now we have enough oxygen for a few weeks till we get our refill.
And Gora, are there more people looking for treatment than you can cope with there?
Yeah, absolutely. Like all the, not only our hospitals, all the other hospitals and the big state hospitals are completely full. And in fact, some of the state hospitals, people are waiting outside. The patients are waiting outside on the car parking lot on the stretcher.
And how do you feel about that, witnessing such awful suffering, such awful pain?
It is. Every day thousands of people are dying. And like every day we are having more than 400,000 people getting affected countrywide. In West Bengal itself, the province I am in, like it's more than 19,000 people getting affected every day. And mind you, this is the government figures. The actual figures might be maybe three times, because the massive queue in front of crematorium or burial ground is a different story.
And Gora, the money that's coming to your foundation from the Irish government, how will you use it?
Thanks. That money, I mean, we're really grateful to our Irish Aid. That's mainly for the running cost of our hospitals. That is going to get to the wages for the medical staff, the nutrition for the patient and their medicines.
How do you see the next number of weeks and months in your country, Gora? Is there any hope at all on the horizon?
Some part of the country, the graph is going downwards, but overall, like say in Calcutta and West Bengal and four other states which recently went through the election, I think the peak is yet to come. So it's going to be worse. Another thing is, it's kind of like you said, it's spreading in the countryside, the rural India, which doesn't have enough, you know, like doctors or healthcare professionals. So that's going to be a big problem.
Yeah, well, Gora, our thoughts, for what it's worth, are with you all, and we will talk again. Thank you very much indeed, Gora Das there, who is logistics manager with the Hope Foundation, which runs a hospital in Kolkata in India.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Good morning again, Darren.
Good morning, Audrey, and we'll start with news of a very important victory for Rory McIlroy last night. He ended his long losing streak at the Wells Fargo Championship, finished with a 68 last night to finish on 10 under par. He won it by a shot, and it's his first victory on tour since November 2019, and the timing really couldn't be any better, because it comes ahead of the US PGA Championship, which takes place in 10 days' time. And a number of noteworthy points on the win last night. It comes just 6 weeks after he started working with his new coach, Pete Cowan. He thanked Pete afterwards, but he also thanked Michael Bannon. He said he'd never mention Pete without talking about Michael too. His caddy, Harry Diamond, played his part as well, especially on 18. His drive found trouble near a stream, and he encouraged Rory to take a drop, which he did, and from there he found the green with an 8-iron and 2-putted for the title. And his all-round game looked much better as well. Most notably, his putting didn't miss from inside 6 feet in all four rounds. And he also confirmed he almost didn't make the start line on Thursday with a neck issue. More on that shortly, but first, what was the overriding emotion after finally getting the win?
I mean, relief that, you know, I've won again. Relief that my season, I feel, is sort of back on track, and more just satisfaction at the journey that I'm on and the process that I've been going through to try to get back to this point. There's been a lot of hard work. I've put my head down. I haven't really looked too much in either direction. I've just tried to do what I need to do, and you know, for a couple of months there, all that hard work seemed like it was not really getting anywhere, wasn't providing me with much. But then it's, you know, as I said at the start, it's such a funny week, thinking that you know, knowing that my game was pretty good coming in here and then have my neck completely lock up on me on the range on Wednesday afternoon, not even thinking I was going to play on Thursday, and then I'm sitting here on Sunday night with a trophy. It's been a bit of a funny week in a way, but I'm just glad that I got through it and played some really good golf over the weekend.
Yeah, he certainly did that. Great performance as well from Niall Carney in the Canaries. Finished with a 61 yesterday, tied for fourth on 19 under par. His best ever finish on the European Tour. Great Britain and Ireland lost to the USA 14-12 in the Walker Cup. Great golf by two Irish players, Mark Power and John Murphy, over the weekend. But unfortunately, both lost their single matches last night. Now, the new GAA season got up and running over the weekend. We had the first round in the Allianz Hurling League. Result of the weekend went to Antrim. They marked their return to Division 1 with a 2-point victory against Clare. Cork scored 5 goals in their 7-point win over Waterford, and Wexford too strong for Laois. We're going to talk to Brendan Cummins shortly, but first let's hear from Kieran Clark on that win over Clare.
As it means everything, when I was saying there, you know, it's only 2 points, but it does mean loads to us, and I think it will mean loads to those watching at home. Again, I hope they're at home cheering us on, and hopefully it'll not be long till they're back out watching us. Perfect start, tough campaign, but you wouldn't want it any other way. You know, you want to be up here playing with the best, you know, challenging yourself, and you know, I think we've done that.
Brendan Cummins joins me. Brendan, was that result of the weekend?
I think it was, Darren, yeah, and it certainly wasn't any major surprise to me. I mean, since Darren Gleeson took over the Antrim team last year, having been a coach up there, he's done a fantastic job. He spoke to Kieran Clark there, you heard he's passionate about the supporters, but I think watching Antrim last year, I mean, Paddy Burke is centre-back, Keelan Malloy around the middle, and the return of Neil McManus to full fitness last year during the league, and the Joe McDonough, he'd only been a bit part player, and it was really frustrating as a hurling man, I suppose, to be looking at him coming on, and he was wondering, was he going to break down, but he was certainly scoring one of the points in the finish to get Antrim over the line. But no, Clare and Antrim are in stark contrast to each other. Clare, you know, they're struggling for form. Going up to Corrigan Park is never an easy place to go, especially if you remember Laois a number of years ago, Darren. I mean, they nearly beat Tipperary above in Croke Park when they had momentum behind them, and Antrim are like that now. They're on the crest of a wave, but certainly big question marks over Clare. And the good news or bad news for Brian Lowen is there's another game next weekend, and if they can win next weekend, it'll give them a little boost and really get them back on the road again.
Yeah, nice one to look forward to at Wexford. Did any other performance catch your eye?
Yeah, I think the performance at Cork was particularly interesting. Below, I suppose, on the racetrack, this Páirc Cliath with the hard ground and all that, they seem to find a little bit of their identity, and I think it's no coincidence to have a fantastic management ticket in there with Kingston from last year. But that little addition of Donal O'Grady, I think, has added that extra bit of bite into their play. The way they tackled down was extremely impressive. I mean, they scored 5 goals, but the foundation for that win was all based around they swarmed, they tackled with huge problems in the Gaelic grounds the night before with the tackle. But Cork seemed to have nailed it against Waterford the weekend. Now they come to Turles next Saturday. It'll be important for them that they build on that, that it's not just green shoots that'll be stamped out. But certainly it was an impressive performance from Cork and Páirc Cliath the weekend.
Let's finish with the new advantage rule. It caused a lot of confusion over the weekend. I don't think there's any harm in me just kind of giving you the wording and giving our listeners the wording of it this morning, Brendan. So traditionally, before this year, player had 5 seconds to make use of possession. That has now changed. Advantage can only be played in 2 circumstances, a goal-scoring opportunity or by creating on time and space. Essentially, no advantage if you're surrounded by a number of other players. How do you think it worked?
I didn't think it worked that hot now, to be honest. I couldn't see why we're trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist. Our referees, while we'd be always giving out and shouting and roaring about them on the line and all, what's he doing this and what's he doing that, I think that it's been crazy stuff. I mean, the Gaelic grounds, there was pullbacks. The Limerick gave away, obviously Jason Ford scored 11 points from frees. Limerick gave him a little tug as the player was getting away just to slow him up. That was going to be a free, and tip players were inside, and the other side of it really was scoring points for fun as well from frees, where Limerick players would have wanted to get that advantage. So hugely frustrating. I think what's going to happen this week, we're going to see an awful lot of altering in the way players are going to go about the tackle, the way the games are going to be played. So the players and coaches will adapt. But certainly I hope to God that we're not seeing an All-Ireland final that turns into a free-taking competition. I can't see why this has been introduced. It wasn't a problem in our game. Black card, perfect. To bring in that, because we had seen a lot of those cynical fouls creeping in. No problem with that, but certainly disadvantage rule. I just hope that it doesn't make our game more stop-start than it needs to be. Hurling is unique and that's so free-flowing. The ball moves so quickly. Just let him play and let him at it. I don't see why this thing was why it was introduced.
Good talking to you, Brendan. Finally, West Brom relegated from the Premier League, lost 3-1 to Arsenal, and Sam Bennett won the green jersey at the Tour of Algarve.
And we're heading to Ennis in County Clare now to see what's happening there with the reopening this morning. Our Midwest correspondent, Cathy Halloran, joins us. Cathy.
Yes, well, I'm here in Ennis and it's back to business for 12,000 businesses and 100,000 workers today as the country reopens. I'm here at Bridget Harron's Hair and Beauty Salon in Ennis. It's been a tough 5 months absence from customers, but they're glad to be getting back. First, I spoke to staff member Brenda Monaghan, who's here at the salon, and she's been busy manning the phones for the past week, literally 10 hours a day, with hundreds of customers looking for appointments. First of all, we speak to Brenda.
Good morning, Bridget Harron here in Beauty. Brenda speaking, how can I help you? Yeah? Yeah, absolutely. I'll pop that in for you.
Brenda, tell me, you've been busy managing phone calls for the last week here at the hairdressers Bridget Harron's in Ennis. Tell me what that's been like and what have clients been asking you?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been here all week going through our appointment list. So we have been going through the backlog of appointments from January till April 1st.
There must be hundreds of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's loads. But we're fitting everybody in and we've a great team of stylists here that absolutely have no problem.
Yes, well, Bridget Harron is the owner of the salon and indeed a past president of the Hairdressers Association of Ireland. She's been explaining to me about getting back to business, but that things are going to be managed very differently this time round.
We're delighted to get back and get our doors finally open. You know, it's been a long, hard 5 months. And, you know, it's just everybody in the town is really excited to start getting the place open. And it's great that the hair and beauty salons are going first this time. You know, we're really thankful that we have got the opportunity to go first this time.
Things are going to be different, though. You're not going to do them things the same way as you did the last time, like bringing staff in really, really early. There's also the question of tests for people's scalps and things like that. Tell me a little bit about that. You have questionnaires out here on the platforms in the salon.
So a lot has changed since the last time, like different things like our insurance company and our manufacturing companies have changed things like skin testing. So everybody, because we've been closed so long, like we would always have skin tested before, but now it's mandatory that you have to have a skin test because people are having allergic reactions. We're watching what's going on in the north and in England.
Tell me about that. Is it that if I had a vaccination or someone had COVID within the last 2 weeks, they're not being advised to have their hair coloured?
So within 2 weeks of having the injection, they're saying not to get your hair coloured, just because we're watching what's happening abroad and we're seeing the implications that it's having. And also as well, people haven't had their hair maybe coloured for the last 5 months. So you have to be very particular, very careful as well as to your procedure going forward.
So what's your hope from today, really, that you'll be able to stay open?
Absolutely. Like, it's fantastic to see the town getting up and going again. Do you know, there'll be a great atmosphere in here today and I hope to see everybody happy and smiling. Well, not with our masks probably, you know, we won't be able to see you smiling, but definitely we smile with our eyes and we're just so grateful to be open again and try to get our business back on the road.
Yes, well, retail is also back for click and collect today before a full resumption of open door business next Monday. Now, Gwen Culligan runs clothes boutiques in Ennis and Nina. She's been telling me about the challenges ahead for retail and how COVID really has forced them to up their game on the online side of business so that they have long-term viability.
We don't know what's ahead. It'll be so exciting to see our customers, first of all, and to welcome everybody back to store. The team is just thrilled to be back. What's ahead, we don't know, but we've been working hard behind the scenes. We've been feeding our website every day. We know the customers have been looking on the website and we think we'll have a whole raft of new customers coming to us once we reopen. They're dying for the store to be open. They want to feel, they want to touch, they want to see.
What about staff training? You're keeping up to date with all of that at the moment.
Well, during lockdown, we've used that time to upskill everyone, train everybody. And everyone now is capable of running the, opening the online, using it. It's at every touch point in both our stores. So we pick our stock and send it out, and we'll be ready for click and collect today. And everybody, Leo, Claire, I have to say, the local enterprise office has been fantastic, mentoring and helping with financial support to get everybody upskilled and to get ourselves better enabled as well.
It's been a tough time for retailers like yourself, but you say that COVID times have forced you to up your game.
Because we've fed the website every day, we've hundreds of items up there. Our sales have grown by 85% in 1 year, and that is just absolutely phenomenal. Just means that we're going to have a good year. We're going to work out okay.
What about the challenges then facing the high street if its online business is getting stronger? What does it mean for the bricks and mortar boutiques and shops across the cities and towns of the country?
Well, I still think there's room for bricks and mortar. So I know it will be changed and certain players won't be there anymore, but I do think there's room for bricks and mortar still.
Well, enjoy today in the hair salon if you're going. Cathy, thank you very much. Cathy Halloran, our Midwest correspondent there, reporting from Ennis in County Clare. Just time to go to Pat Davitt, auctioneer in Westmeath, CEO of the Institute of Professional Auctioneers and Valuers. Pat, are property viewings resuming today?
Yes, property viewings are resuming today, which is great for auctioneers. There's nothing as bad as being having properties to sell and can't view them. So we're delighted today by inspection and by appointment. You'll be able to view properties today in conjunction with, obviously, the joint sector protocol.
Because what's been happening over the last few months, people could view them online, but that's not the same thing.
People could view properties online, and they were really sort of bidding on the property and bidding on the blind and bidding to view the property as opposed to bidding to buy the property, which was, in many cases, it has helped to increase the price of properties. But now, with the people being able to go and view the property, obviously, that hopefully will bring some back normality back to the market. And it will also bring it for vendors putting properties on the market as well, because many were afraid to put the properties on the market when they couldn't be viewed. But yeah, Now they can obviously be viewed. So hopefully more properties will come back on the market as well now, okay, which is going to be very good for the market.
Well, it's by appointment only, no unannounced walk-ins. Exactly. Pat, we leave it there. Thank you very much. Pat Davitt there, auctioneer in Westmeath, CEO of the IPAV.